Today is Friday, December 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Heidi Adams-Fitzpatrick in Washington. Coming up, VOA's Jeff Seldon takes a look back at the Islamic State in 2019.
While thousands of captured fighters and tens of thousands of their relatives languished in makeshift prisons and displaced persons camps.
Also ahead, even as global carbon emissions rise, use of coal declines. And it's been a rough ride for the British royal family. We take a look at what's been a bumpy year at Buckingham Palace. Our top story this evening, a Kazakhstan plane with more than 90 people on board crashed shortly after takeoff early Friday, killing at least 12 people and seriously injuring more than 20 others. Authorities say Kazakhstan's Civil Aviation Committee said the Bek airplane hit a concrete fence and a two-story building as it was taking off from Almaty International Airport. Flight 2-100, a Fokker 100 aircraft, was heading to the capital Nur Sultan, formerly known as Astana, when it lost altitude at 7:22 a.m. local time. Authorities say all Bek Air and Fokker 100 flights in Kazakhstan were immediately suspended pending the investigation of the crash. They have not suggested any possible cause of the accident. The manufacturer of Fokker 100, a medium-sized twin turbofan jet airliner, went bankrupt in 1996, and the production of the plane stopped the following year. Global carbon dioxide emissions rose by 0.6% this year, according to a new estimate. That's at a time when scientists say the world needs to sharply cut greenhouse gas emissions in order to stave off the worst of climate change. There was a glimpse of good news in the data, though. Burning coal for energy is the single largest source of CO2, and coal use declined a bit this year. Some experts say a global shift away from dirty fuel is now underway. VOA's Steve Barragona has more.
This year, three of the country's top 10 coal producers went bankrupt. They were the latest casualties of an industry in decline. U.S. coal production is down more than a third from its 2008 peak, and it's expected to keep falling. Kentucky Energy and Environment Secretary Charles Snavely is a former coal executive. He delivered a grim prognosis for the industry at a conference in May.
I think that the risk is more to the downside than the upside. And if we're already projecting a significant decrease over time, I think that it will probably be worse than that.
President Donald Trump campaigned in 2016 on reviving the coal industry. He has loosened pollution regulations that he says are holding the industry back.
How about we give that to the miners? Yeah.
But coal-burning power plants are closing across the country anyway. Advances in drilling have made natural gas cheaper, and the cost of wind and solar power have plunged. It's happened faster than expected, says University of Wyoming economist Robert Godbey.
Market forces have moved the coal market to a place most of us didn't anticipate in a really short period of time.
And coal industry jobs have not recovered since Trump took office. The shifting market is one reason emissions from coal worldwide were down almost 1% this year, says Global Carbon Project Chair Rob Jackson at Stanford University.
One thing we're seeing is a really rapid drop in coal use, both here in the United States and also in Europe. I mean, both places, coal use for this year alone is down about 10%. Which is just really surprising.
But coal use increased this year in India and in China, the world's largest coal consumer by far. That nearly canceled out the declines elsewhere. And both countries plan to build more coal plants. That raises concerns about future CO2 emissions. But those plants may not get much use. China especially has already built more plants than it uses, says Tim Buckley with the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis.
So in other words, every coal-fired power plant is only being used every second day on average. So you are really just building idle new capacity that's surplus, redundant to the country's needs.
But even as coal declines, greenhouse gas emissions from burning oil keep climbing, and natural gas use is soaring. That's bad news for the climate, Jackson says.
I think the offsets, the decreases in coal in countries like the United States and Europe, just aren't enough to stabilize global emissions and ultimately drive them down.
To really tackle climate change, he says, the world has to get serious about cutting all fossil fuels. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
Among the top stories in the world, Russia's new intercontinental weapon that can fly 27 times the speed of sound became operational Friday, the Russian defense minister reported to President Vladimir Putin. Police beat and detained a group of protesters in New Delhi on Friday as they attempted to demonstrate against a new citizenship law that has triggered nationwide protests in recent weeks. A tall helicopter with seven people aboard disappeared in Hawaii, and a search is underway in weather conditions the U.S. Coast Guard describes as challenging. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan on Friday unveiled prototypes of a domestically produced electric car, moving closer to Turkey's first domestically made national automobile. This is International Edition on The Voice of America. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is breathing a sigh of relief after a landslide win in the battle for leadership of the Likud party. Netanyahu beat his challenger Gideon Saar last night, winning more than 72% of the vote. This gives Netanyahu a boost going into Israel's third general election in a year, scheduled for early March. Saar was seen as the first serious challenger to Netanyahu in the decade that he has led the Likud party. The overwhelming victory comes in spite of the fact that Netanyahu has been indicted in three corruption cases. He insists he is innocent and that he can be both prime minister and defend himself in court at the same time. Now, Netanyahu faces a much greater challenge in March after failing to form a government in the last two elections held in April and September. His best hope of escaping prosecution would be to secure a 61-seat majority in a parliament that is willing to grant him immunity. After fits and starts, the past year saw the collapse of the Islamic State's terror group's self-declared caliphate, with the last scrap of IS-controlled territory in Syria finally succumbing to US-backed forces in March. US Special Forces struck another blow in October, finding and killing IS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. But as VOA's national security correspondent Jeff Selden reports, IS seems to have been able to withstand the heavy blows, starting already to reassert itself across the globe. Libya's internationally recognized government has formally requested that Turkey provide air, ground and sea military support to fend off an offensive of eastern forces to take the capital Tripoli. Turkey's president Tayyip Erdogan says his country will send troops to Libya as soon as its parliament approves it. They will support the government of national accord, which is backed by the United Nations. Forces led by General Khalifa Haftar have besieged Tripoli for months, trying to capture it and take control of the country. U.S. President Donald Trump and Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi agreed in a phone call on Thursday that they reject foreign exploitation in Libya and urged parties to the conflict to take urgent steps to resolve the fighting. VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shinawi discusses these developments with Jason Pack, a non-resident fellow at the Middle East Institute.
Even before 2019 began, Islamic State was on the run. No longer able to rule territory in Iraq, there were some who said the terror group's time had come to an end.
I've been president for almost 2 years, and we've really stepped it up, and we have won against ISIS.
It was a claim U.S. President Donald Trump would make again and again.
We just took over, you kept hearing.
We seem to have had a technical problem there. Here now is Mohammed Al-Shinawi's interview with Jason Pack, a non-resident fellow at the Middle East Institute.
Well, this move is quite serious. It's been brewing for a long time, since the November 27th announcement of the Turkey-Libya MOUs, one about a maritime exclusive economic zone, and then this about defense cooperation. Essentially, what has happened is, since General Haftar and his so-called Libyan National Army have attacked Tripoli in April, they have received more and more foreign support from Russia, Egypt, Saudi, Jordan, and to some extent France. And none of the major Western powers who support the General National Accord government in Tripoli have been willing to provide that defensive support. Only Turkey is willing to backstop the GNA government. And as a result, the more outside support Haftar has, Prime Minister Sarraj and the GNA need to rely on Turkey to prevent the collapse of Tripoli and the fall of their government.
U.S. President Donald Trump and Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi agreed in a phone call yesterday that they reject foreign exploitation in Libya and urged parties to the conflict to take urgent steps to stop the fighting. What do you make of that when Egypt is backing one side of the Libyan conflict and calling for lifting UN embargo on arms to the National Libyan Army?
Egypt and the UAE outwardly support the UN process, but in reality they give arms and support to General Haftar. However, their role is more sophisticated in that the Egyptians in particular wish to dominate the Libya file, and that requires mediation between both sides. And they wish to frame the Turks as aggressors for deploying troops in essentially what is a defensive position. So it's convenient for them to say publicly, we're calling for all outside intervention to cease. Making the other side look like they're the ones who are intervening is convenient for public relations purposes. But what has happened is essentially only Turkey now is debating formally sending its official army, whereas the Egyptians have trainers and the UAE pay money for mercenaries and the Russians send mercenaries. The Turks would be the first who are openly violating the arms embargo by sending their formal army.
Al-Mahdi Al-Majrabi, representative of the Libyan delegation to the UN, criticized in a letter to the Security Council Egypt's rejection of the two deals signed between the GNA and Turkey, which has granted Ankara a green light for military intervention in Libya. Could that lead eventually to a military confrontation in Libya between Turkey and Egypt?
I could see, in fact, that it could do the opposite. So long as those supporting Haftar feel the more mercenaries they send or the more drones, there won't be any pushback. That promotes that intervention. However, if Turkish troops, formal army troops, are sent to Tripoli, that could act as a tripwire, because neither Egypt nor Russia will want to have on their hands the killing of any Turkish troops, because that could present a regional escalation. I could see this reality where putting Turkish troops in Tripoli acts as a backstop and a tripwire and prevents the advance of other outside actors and could actually be a positive step to allow horse trading at the international level at various summits and private phone calls between leaders.
Algerian president has chaired a rare meeting of the High Security Council to discuss contingency plan for Turkish military intervention in Libya. What does that mean?
Essentially, those neutral powers in northwestern Africa, Algeria, Tunis, Morocco, do not want to see the collapse of the Tripoli government. They're not willing to, for a whole range of reasons, give their own military support, but they would be happy for the Turks to backstop the GNA, just as I believe fundamentally the U.S., the U.K., and Italy would be as well. So no doubt they're doing contingency planning. Hey, maybe the Turks are going to do this heavy lifting for us and prevent the collapse of the GNA and total chaos in Libya, which is what would happen if Haftar took the capital. So it makes sense that various powers, both in northwestern Africa and in Europe and America, are working with the Turks to make sure that this step is implemented in a way that it's not seen as an intervention, but a defensive tripwire.
And that was Jason Pack with the Middle East Institute speaking there with VOA's Mohammed Elshenawy. VOA's International Edition continues.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London!
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour.
Whoa.
Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews.
Ooh.
Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world.
Ah.
Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Heidi Adams-Fitzpatrick. U.S. officials say a Congolese woman has died in immigration custody in the state of Texas. Ben Thomas with the Associated Press has more.
An asylum seeker has died in government custody at the border in South Texas. U.S. Customs and Border Protection says the woman was a 41-year-old from Congo. She arrived at an official port of entry in Laredo, Texas, Christmas Eve, with paperwork that documented a previous medical condition. Medical personnel cleared her to be detained overnight. But come Christmas morning, the woman told CBP officers she had abdominal pain and had vomited. The agency says it contacted emergency personnel immediately and had her taken to a local hospital, but her condition declined rapidly and she died there. According to a statement CBP gave members of Congress, the woman was diagnosed with acute kidney failure. I'm Ben Thomas.
The Philippines has banned two U.S. lawmakers from visiting the country and is threatening tighter travel restrictions on Americans after the U.S. Congress backed a jailed government critic. President Rodrigo Duterte ordered his Bureau of Immigration to block entry of Senators Richard Durbin and Patrick Leahy. Durbin and Leahy were behind a provision passed by Congress this month as part of the 2020 budget, which seeks to block any Philippines official involved in the detention of Senator Leila De Lima from entering the U.S. Lima was charged with drug offenses in 2017 after she led an investigation into mass killings during Duterte's notorious anti-drugs crackdown. The Philippines grants visa-free entry to U.S. citizens for up to 30 days. Government statistics show nearly 800,000 Americans visited the Philippines in the first 9 months of this year. Millions of Filipinos have relatives who are U.S. citizens. The Pacific island of Samoa has been in the headlines for weeks now following a deadly outbreak of measles. Doctors there are racing to contain the virus that has so far infected thousands of people. At least 80 have died, nearly all of them children under five. It all began in July last year when two infants died after nurses incorrectly mixed their vaccines with another medicine. The incident resulted in the suspension of the National Measles Vaccination Program. Only 31% of Samoans were vaccinated around the time of the outbreak. My colleague Ira Melman recently spoke with Dr. Anthony Fauci, the head of the U.S. National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. He explains how the small island nation found itself in the grips of a massive outbreak.
Well, measles is one of the most highly contagious infectious diseases known to man. It is really true. If someone has measles and goes into a room and coughs and sneezes, measles in the air and in the environment can last anywhere from 2 to 4 hours, and someone who even walks into that room without direct contact with the person who has measles, but measles had been in a particular space, that person can get measles. So it's highly contagious. The other thing is that the vaccine against measles is one of the most effective vaccines known to man. It's about 97% effective. But in order to prevent outbreaks, you need the community to have a level of vaccination of approximately 93-94%. In Samoa, it was as low as 50-55%. But what has happened now is a catastrophe since so few individuals, percentage-wise, were vaccinated. There have now been thousands of cases, and at least 60 people have died thus far, which really belies this issue that measles is not a serious disease. It is a terribly serious disease in its potential and can kill and cause a degree of disease and suffering, as we are currently seeing in Samoa.
So why do you think their vaccination level was as low as it was?
Well, it was a combination of reasons. You know, one of them was just letting it slip, so the public health accessibility to vaccines was not great. And then there was an unfortunate situation, which was a public relations problem. The public didn't trust the vaccine because there was an accident, a mistake. So some time ago where vaccine was improperly mixed with a muscle relaxant leading to the death of two infants, which led to a field day on the part of the anti-vaxxers because they used that accidental adverse event as a way of preaching to the people that vaccines are dangerous and you shouldn't use them. And that unfortunately led to a very strong anti-vaccine movement in Samoa, which was the major contribution to this problem.
Has there ever been a situation like this where almost all of the population, at least in recent times, all of the population has been exposed to the disease and so many have come down with it?
Well, sure. It was the pre-vaccination era. This is exactly what happened prior to the development of a safe and effective vaccine. For measles, we had outbreaks like this all over the world. So this is not anything that's new or novel. It's just turning the clock back to the time when we didn't have vaccines. As I mentioned, only about 50 to 55% of the people in Samoa are vaccinated. You've got to get that vaccine level up above 90%.
And that was Dr. Anthony Fauci at the U.S. National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, speaking with VOA's Ira Melman. It was a challenging year for the British royal family, with problems including a potential rift between Prince William and Harry, Britain's laborious effort to exit the European Union, and a scandal involving Prince Andrew and a disastrous TV interview in which he defended his friendship with sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Reporter Amy Gutman in London spoke with International Edition's Laurie London about the tough year for the royals.
Some of these changes have been propelled by the Prince Andrew controversy, shall we say. And that's because Prince Charles, along with his father, Prince Philip, really felt very strongly that Prince Andrew needed to step down from his royal duties. He was becoming a huge distraction and a huge liability for the royal family. And it's believed that Prince Andrew has always been the favorite son of the Queen. And so there was a sense that she might not do what needed to be done, i.e. force him to step aside and sort of hang up his royal uniform, as it were. So Prince Philip had summoned Prince Charles, who is next in line to the throne, to come for a meeting to discuss how to handle the next step. And the Queen has actually acquiesced in this case, and she had a conversation. She summoned Prince Andrew, her favorite son, to the palace and told him that he must retire from public life and that he was causing too much harm and too much reputational damage to the royal family. And so it's believed that through this process and through some pretty decisive actions, which are being lauded by the British public, by Prince Charles, he's starting to show his leadership qualities and very good judgment. He envisions a slimmed-down version of the royal family, getting rid of some of the extended family in terms of appearances and in terms of relying on the royal purse and just a more streamlined royal family. I think he's aware that there's a greater demand for transparency, especially when it comes to financials and what's being spent, because after all, much of this is coming from the public purse.
When is this all supposed to transpire, and how big of a deal is this?
This is not necessarily a big deal. This is a very organic, natural progression. After all, the Queen is turning 95 years old in 18 months. That's the age at which her husband, Prince Philip, retired from public life. It makes total sense that she would choose to do the same thing. And 18 months is about the point at which you would hope that a succession plan would start to take shape, more than a plan, but actually a practice. And so it makes a lot of sense that Prince Charles would be much more involved in some of the decision-making and operational duties, though I must say, the Queen has not ceded to him in any way. The Queen is still in charge.
Where does this leave Prince William?
Prince William has also stepped up. Prince William supported Charles in his views about Prince Andrew, which is William's uncle. And he's also become much more respected for his views and for taking a decisive opinion about matters and not just sitting back and remaining neutral. The public has really respected the fact that Prince William has taken a stand here.
Amy Gutman in London there, speaking with my colleague Laurie London. You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thank you to our director, Dan Brown, our engineer, Thomas Blondet. I'm Hayley Adams-Fitzpatrick in Washington, wishing you a great day.